Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Why are there so few female financial advisors out there? And why does that matter for clients? And why does that matter for the industry? Plus, what can be done about it? That is a big topic, and we'll explore it with Judy Parody from strategymarketing.ca. She's got some ideas. Then, it seems like more disability claims are being filed lately related to mental health. Nainish Kotak from Kotak Personal Injury Law will take us through the process of making a claim and how to increase the probability that it will be accepted by your insurer. And financial planning for families with someone who has a disability, Graham Treby will be here to talk about something called the Henson Trust. Plus, Credit Counseling Canada's new Bill of Rights for Canadians in Debt. CEO Michelle Pamels will be here. And on our blogger spotlight, we'll talk to Sherry from Save, Spend, Splurge. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Earn like a princess, spend like a duchess. That is the motto of our next guest. She wears a big floppy hat in her photo and goes by a single name, Sherry. But otherwise, she's pretty public about her journey to financial freedom. Sherry runs Save, Spend, Splurge, and she joins us now from an undisclosed location. Are you in the FBI Witness Protection Program, Sherry?
I am not, but I actually do disclose where I am. Everybody knows I'm from Montreal. So
okay. All right. I didn't see that on your homepage. You're from Montreal.
I'm just a transplant.
Fantastic. Earn like a princess, spend like a duchess. What does that mean to you?
For me, it means that I'm really focused on making as much money as possible, in whatever way that means. Either it means with side hustles, or it means negotiating a higher pay each time there was a review, or just getting a better job. All of that matters a lot. And I think a lot of that gets overlooked. When we think about money, we think only about the other side, which is the spending like a duchess part, which is saving, economizing, clipping coupons, you know. So for me, there's two sides of it. It's making as much as possible and spending as little as you reasonably can and still keeping a balance in your life.
Yeah, you do have a measured approach here, and we'll talk a bit about some of your passions and some of the things that you choose to spend on. But I want to get to your story just as the foundation here. After climbing out of a pretty big debt, you hit a personal net worth of $1 million at age 36. What Yes. was the single biggest change you made? If you had to boil it down to one thing.
It's learning how to manage my money. Financial literacy is so key. I can't even, if I could sing this from a rooftop, so I would.
Right.
It's the one thing that made me realize how little I knew about my money and how I wish I'd started much, much, much younger. So okay. Financial literacy.
You have three basic questions about spending on your blog. Can I pay for it in cash? Will I still hit all my money goals? And do I love it? How
yes.
hard is it to answer that last question in particular? Because people who have a predisposition to spending often love lots of things.
This is me. I love everything. So everything I touch, I think I can't get rid of it. I love it. I want to buy it all. In fact, I want to buy it, its brothers, its sisters, and all the different colors it comes in.
I did but notice the ancient Greek sapphire platinum sandals for $171.17.
And that's a low amount for me. Okay.
This is wow.
That's not considered an expensive pair of shoes, but I digress. For me, it's more if you really want to buy something, first of all, I keep a wish list. I'm not just randomly buying things that I like, which I used to do when I was younger. I used to go into a store and just randomly pick things and think, oh, I want this and this and the cheapest possible, because I was all about quantity. As I got older, it was more about quality. And because it's more about quality, I'm way pickier. I won't buy things that are of a fast fashion sort of, you know, mainstream retail brand, unless I really like the style. And I'll go for something that's basically designer, but on a budget, which means secondhand. So if you really like something, you have to think, how much do I like it in the sense that will I be able to wear it often? Is it just a one trick pony that I like just because some influencer is wearing it? Or is it something that fills a gap in my wardrobe? So that's, you know, the second question that I ask myself. The first one is, am I going to derail any money goals if I purchase this item. And that's the number one thing that I use as a filter for purchasing.
And what are some examples of money goals? Because that can be defined in lots of different ways.
Well, this year I had a couple of goals. I wanted to make about $50,000 in side income. So I hit that. I also I wanted to save about 80% of my income, which I also did as well.
Wow.
I mean, it's things like that, right? You set goals thinking to yourself, hey, I want to save 80%. If I buy this, it's going to drop me to 79. So do I really want it? I really want to hit that goal. And I'm one of those type A, I want to hit all the goals that I have and do all the check marks on the boxes. So that really helps me when I set these kinds of challenges for myself. My other goal was to also hit 150K in income. COVID actually had me lose my contract at the beginning of the year. So I almost didn't make it, but I think I'll hit it with my side incomes. So it'll be all right. And my long-term goal is to have $1 million in invested assets. So meaning not in my house, not in my car. I mean like in the bank and in the stock market. So right now I'm a millionaire, but with assets.
I mentioned that you're private about your, you know, your name and your face, but not about your spending. $44.46 on medical spending, including magnesium pills. I love the details. I want to ask you, how do you track your spending? And do you think you'll reach a point at which you won't track anymore?
I'm going to answer the second question first. I will never not track. I'm a statistics freak.
Right.
I love knowing.
So in your retirement, you'll be like, I'm 98 and I spent $42.75 on denture cream.
Yes, that is exactly going to be me. You'll be able to ask me, hey, when did you buy that denture cream? I'll say, oh, let me check. April 2nd.
Right.
And I actually use something that I developed while I was getting out of all that debt called, which I call now the budgeting tool or the wealth building tool. And I sell it on thebudgetingtool.com for $25. And I actually donate all the net proceeds of that to charities, which actually helps lower some of my taxable income, which is the benefit that I get, the altruistic benefit. And I just use that to track everything. I have my expenses in there. I track my income. I track all of my side incomes. I track my net worth. There's basically nothing that I think is important that I don't track in this tool.
And how come you don't use a third party site like a Quicken or a Mint or something like that, that just goes around scraping your bank accounts and putting it into a handy dandy cash flow?
You just said it. It's because it scrapes my information. And for something that's free, I always question myself, why is it free? It's free for a reason, because they're probably taking that information, using it for statistics to try and sell more or to figure out where people are spending their money to do, you know, to sell it for marketing purposes. And I don't like that because I'm quite private in general, and I'm also a security freak.
Right. So, and it sounds like you like putting pen to paper or numbers into the spreadsheet. Now, for the record, Quicken is a fee for service. You do pay for it, but I take your point that people are trying to get your data any way that they can. Now, what would be your number one tip for people who are looking to achieve a specific money goal?
A specific money goal. I would say that if they're trying to hit a money goal, they have to understand their why. Why do they want, for instance, to have 20% down for a home? Is it because they want to buy a home and then that way they can start decorating it? Or I don't know. I mean, you have to figure out what your why is. If you want to hit financial independence, what's your why? Why do you want to reach that? So you can stop working completely, so that you have the financial security of not ever having to work again, which was my why. Or is it just because you want to hit some random goal? I find that random goals don't work for me, especially. I need to know why I want to be there, and I don't want to have to think about it. For instance, the reason why I wanted to reach financial independence was because I didn't want to go to work for a crappy client anymore and have to take their crap. So that's the reason why.
Right.
That's my why.
You are prolific in the content that you create. What are the top two or three articles that you posted on the blog that seem to have resonated the most with your readers?
Net worth. Anything to do with, you know, benchmarking your net worth, how what age you are for what net worth you have. Those always do really well because, you know, we're human. We just want to know how we're doing versus everybody else.
What is one topic you wish you never had to talk about ever again in a conversation or on your blog? And what is one that you could talk about every single day, all day, and still be excited about it?
Okay, the topic I would never want to ever talk about is probably anything to do with insurance. I know.
Oh my gosh, that's mine too.
I you know what? This it drives me crazy because I don't understand some of the terms in there because I've made it a point to not have to understand it. So
now please tell you have a child. Please tell me you have life insurance.
I do not because I don't need it. We're completely debt free. We have more than enough assets that he doesn't.
Well, why wouldn't you get a simple term life plan? Like
because I don't understand it, Bruce.
Oh my gosh! Clearly, I've got some education too. You should let me do a guest post on your blog. Term life is cheap.
Okay, let me Google it. Let me Google this. I'm going to write it down right now.
You Google that. Okay, so that's what you don't want to talk about. What do yes. you want to talk about?
I could talk about shopping and spending your money in a smart manner. Until the cows come home. The second topic is financial independence for women. That one I hit pretty hard on because I feel like women are very underserved in terms of the money community, in terms of being heard, in terms of not being shamed for basic mm-hmm. purchases that they may like, such as, you know, makeup, skincare, all the things
and
that I like.
And the ancient Greek platinum sandals that I mentioned earlier. Come yeah. on.
Those are
amazing.
Those are cheap. Sir, those were cheap. Considering
I don't know.
For
I
what
don't buy
were.
Shoes. $171 is more than I've probably ever paid on a pair of shoes.
See? Exactly. That's why women need a role model like myself.
Yeah, they need
to show
it. There is a gender bias here. It is.
Yes.
It's true.
It's. I mean, you're probably wearing, you know, a plastic bag with some, some insulation.
You're not
your
far
boots.
Off. I was on television earlier today, so I'm not wearing a plastic bag, but I am wearing shoes with holes in them because my toes poke through. They're my old runners. See? I wear them as slippers. So many secrets we've uncovered today here, except for your full name, and I will never disclose anything that I have learned privately. Sherry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And best of luck with the future of your blog. It is Save, Spend, Splurge. And you should check it out now. And check out those sandals. They're amazing.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The pandemic has taken an incredible toll on people, especially on mental health. Tangible things like job loss and financial stress, and less tangible things like an uncertainty about the future and a lack of control. For a lot of people, this is affecting productivity at work, potentially putting their job at risk. Now, many employers have coverage if you need to file a mental health disability claim. Today, we're going to look at how that all works. Nanish Kotek is the founder of Kotek Personal Injury Law, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You have seen an increase in the number of mental health disability claims crossing your desk. By how much?
I would say, Bruce, by at least 50%. And we noticed this really into April, getting into the summer where we're seeing many more denials of mental health claims. So it's quite shocking, but yes, I've seen a big jump. And I think there's a number of reasons for this.
Why?
Okay, first of all, in general, mental health claims are more readily denied because it's invisible. You know, you're not going to find it on MRI, you're not going to find it on an x-ray. So often we see denials based on what's called insufficient medical evidence. And what we're seeing during the pandemic is not just with the new claims of anxiety due to the pandemic, but the increase to the symptoms of those who had pre-existing mental illness, such as anxiety, depression, OCD, panic attacks. For people who were already vulnerable, this has been almost like a coffin. It's been quite severe. We have many people who simply, first of all, they feel isolated to begin with, but now being asked not to speak with others or you know meet with others has made things considerably worse. Their fear of contracting COVID. In addition to the fears that and the anxiety they had in the first place has made things worse. Furthermore, what we're seeing is more claims from those who are, you know, they're frontline workers, but not so much the police and ambulance and fire and hospital workers, although we have seen some claims from nurses. But they're trained in a way to deal with pressure situations. But what we have seen is people who work in manufacturing, people who work frontline in grocery stores, in liquor stores, simply not being able to cope with the anxiety of catching COVID, and particularly when, again, when they've had something pre-existing, it's sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, where they just cannot work, and they're making their claims, and those claims are often being denied on the basis, well, you know, we think you can, there's not enough evidence, or we think you can do some other work, so to speak.
So what do people need to do to lower the likelihood that they will get denied? What is the process? What is the paperwork? What advice do you have that will reduce the number of clients coming to you to fight their claim on their behalf?
First of all, to make a disability claim, there's generally three forms that need to be filled out. The physician statement, which is crucial. That is the statement from the treating doctor who's going to set out what the impairments are and how it affects the ability to work. There's the employee statement, which is the personal statement of the insured person who is making the claim in terms of what's going on in their life, why they can't work. And then the form filled out by the employer. And these, again, are for group policies through employers. The form filled out by the employer, which is more factual in nature, the salary and when the last date of work was. Most important, I see claims denied because the suggestion that the person, and particularly those who are suffering mental illness, are not following guidelines of their treating practitioners. So I think it's very important to certainly when you meet with a family doctor, you meet with a psychiatrist or psychologist, give all your symptoms and try to follow the suggested guidelines in terms of treatment. It becomes difficult, in the sense that to get a psychiatrist appointment, even pre-COVID, was often taking 6, 7, 8 months up to a year. Obviously, during the pandemic, it's a lot longer because these appointments are primarily virtual. The cost of a psychologist, if the disability benefits are not approved or if they're cut off, usually the employer will stop the medical benefits. This happens quite often. So even paying for the cost of a therapist or a, you know, psychologist, psychotherapist becomes difficult. So it is difficult, no question, to get the treatment that someone needs when they have mental illness and they have a disability claim. But I still think, you know, do your best to follow the guidelines, mm-hmm. suggestions of your family doctor or other treating practitioners to prevent the argument being put to you that, well, you haven't followed treatment recommendations and therefore right. you are not entitled to disability benefits.
And both to prevent the argument, but also to ensure that you're doing everything you can to be responsible for your mental health, of course. Social media is also an issue that you flagged. What would insurance be looking for if they're trolling my Facebook?
Right. So, you know, traditionally, we always envision the cloak and dagger, the hiring of private investigators and surveillance and following and filming. Certainly that can happen. But what is quite easy for insurance companies is to scour social media. Often people keep outdated LinkedIn page open. So, for example, they can't work, but they leave their LinkedIn page that, you know, seeking this job or with these skills or working at this location when it's not entirely correct. So, you know, if you're going to keep that LinkedIn page, for example, make sure it's accurate. If you're not working, then you know, don't put your working obviously there. So be up to date with it. Secondly, I would suggest, look, we as human beings tend to put our best foot forward. If we're going to put something on Facebook, people tend to put happy moments, pictures that maybe just tell a moment in time, but not the whole story about a person's life or their day-to-day activities. So just, you know, be cognizant. If you're going to post, you know, I wouldn't post those happy pictures unless you're truly happy most of the time. The other option would be, I think it's very important, is to, for things like Facebook and Instagram, is to make them private. Because courts are less likely to order disclosure of those social media right. pieces if they are private to begin with.
Right now, it's obviously easy to find.
Very easy to find.
You're a lawyer, so I'm not going to ask you to be objective here, but when do you believe an individual should seek out legal help on getting support for a mental health disability claim? Just got about 30 seconds left.
Well, I try to be objective because if I'm not, you know, I have to be upfront with my clients. I try to be. But I would suggest, look, insurance companies offer an internal appeal process, which is like the right hand judging the left hand. It usually, almost all the time, is a no again. I would suggest as soon as you receive a denial from a disability insurer, contact a lawyer who does indeed practice in the area of short and long-term disability law.
Nainish, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Nainish Kotak is the founder of Kotak Personal Injury Law, and we were talking about mental health disability claims and what some of the reasons are why those claims might get declined. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, what is a Henson Trust? Graham Treby is an expert in financial planning for families with a member who has a disability. He's got some really helpful insight on that. And later, the Bill of Rights for Canadians in Debt. We'll talk with Credit Counseling Canada's Michelle Pommels. Also, if you are looking for some book resources to help you deal with debt or investing or whatever it is, I've got one, mine, Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. That's the title. You can find it at any online store.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
For families that include a member who has a disability, there can be additional complexity in how they manage their finances. That includes during their lives and after their lives have ended, too. Quite often, a child with a disability will need care and support long after the parents are no longer living. One way to ensure that that happens is to create a trust. A Henson Trust is specifically designed to support those with disabilities. Joining me now from Stouffville, Ontario is Graham Treby. He is a principal at Bright Futures Ability Network. Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
I have a friend with a kid with a disability, and she said to me, I can never die. Because I am the one. This is a big concern for families and a feeling you must understand. Tell us about Jenny and tell us how you came to be focused on this area.
Sure, I'd be pleased to. Jenny is my youngest daughter, and she's a young lady with multiple disabilities, including developmental delay, seizure disorder, cerebral palsy, just a whole lot of goodies put into one little package. And back in 1990, my wife and I realized that there is a slight chance that we won't die. I mean, I'm planning on living forever, but
good. I think that's a good plan.
I think it is, and so far so good.
Yeah.
But just in case, we thought we had better do some planning for our daughter. And we found very, very quickly that there are very few people that could help us. There was a huge number of questions and very few answers, and nobody really knew the answer. So ultimately, my wife and I did the research ourselves, and it just made a lot of sense for me to give up my accounting career and to focus on sharing the information that we found about how to provide for our daughter with other families. So I've been doing that since 1993 on a full-time basis, and I've been helping literally hundreds of families put together plans to provide for their sons and daughters with disabilities.
What are some examples of how financial planning is different for families with a member living with a disability?
Well, and part of your introduction was very, very precise on that. One issue is that typical planning for people, typical families plan for their own future, for maybe their retirement, and maybe leaving a little bit of money to their children after they're gone. But when you're dealing with a child or a family member with a disability, you have to plan for maybe 40 or 50 years beyond your death. So it's a very different set of criteria and timelines that you're looking at. And you also have to deal with the Ontario government. In Ontario, we have to deal with the Ontario government's program called the ODSP, and that's the Ontario Disability Support Program. It has a very cumbersome set of rules, regulations, and restrictions on assets and income that a person with a disability can have and still retain support from the Ontario government.
One of the ideas, one of the potential vehicles that a family could set up is something called a Henson Trust. How does that work?
Well, a Henson Trust is it's a trust agreement that you typically set up in your will, you as a parent of a person with a disability. And the beauty of that particular thing is that you set the wording up in your will, and when you die, money gets deposited into the trust for the benefit of your son or daughter with a disability. And as long as that person's alive, money has to be used for their benefit at the total discretion of the trustees, the people you leave behind to manage the money. And this went through a court case. The typical nickname is the Henson Trust, the Henson court case. And ultimately, in September of 1989, the courts determined that the person with a disability has absolutely no control over the spending of the money held in the trust. And as such, the court determined that it's not an asset of the person with a disability for ODSP purposes. Hmm. And what that all means is that the person can have unlimited amounts of money in the trust and can still retain their entitlement to the ODSP program.
How onerous is it to set this sort of thing up?
It's really not terribly difficult if you know what you're doing. Without that, of course, it's very difficult. But if you go to a lawyer who understands and knows the ins and outs of the Henson Trust, it's really quite a simple task. The difficulty becomes ultimately when you're gone and the trustees now have to learn how to manage the money within the guidelines of the Trustee Act and also within the guidelines of the ODSP regulations.
You mentioned that this could be a scenario for the child that is decades long, and you know, a trustee may not live for decades. How do the parents who are setting this up ensure that not just the trust structure, but that the trustees will be able to carry out their duties for what could be a very long period of time?
And you're right, it could be hopefully a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. Essentially, one of the ways is to do some succession planning right within the trust document or within the will, where you appoint a primary trustee and then successor trustees. People can also give the trustees that they appoint the ability to appoint their replacements. So there's a number of techniques. We wouldn't look at appointing grandma and grandpa as trustees. We pick the siblings, someone of similar age to the person with a disability, and that makes it a little more viable in the long term as well.
Some of our listeners will hear the word trust and think, I'm not a multimillionaire. There is no way I would have enough money to have a trust fund. Who is this best for, and do income levels and asset levels matter?
Income and, well, particularly asset levels, the amounts going into the trust certainly do matter. There's not really a point of setting up a trust for $10,000 or something as small as that. But on the other hand, many families are using life insurance to magnify the value of their estate to leave into the trust. So that's a way of turning very small monthly deposits into pretty substantial payouts when the parents die.
How do they go about doing that? Do you mean a permanent life insurance plan or a term life on the parents' life?
A permanent plan is important because certainly with a term plan, they're designed by insurance companies to end. First of all, they're designed to go up in price to become unaffordable, but also they expire, usually expire at age 65, 70, whatever the age is. So you want to make sure that you have a policy that's in place that, number one, doesn't go up in price, so it's unaffordable. And more importantly, you want to make sure you have a policy that's not going to expire before you do. So permanent plans are the best way to go.
The other plan out there that certainly many people still need to learn about is the Registered Disability Savings Plan. How does that connect to the Henson Trust? Are they distinct? Do they need to operate in tandem?
Well, a Henson Trust can actually feed the RDSP, and the RDSP is the Registered Disability Savings Plan. It's designed to be a long-term savings plan for people with disabilities. The beauty of that particular program is that when we put money into it, the government matches it with significant grants and bonds. In fact, the federal government will put up to $90,000 of grants and bonds into the plan for us. So it's pretty decent. And then when money is in the plan, it doesn't count against the ODSP, nor do any withdrawals from the plan count as income against ODSP. So it's a way, it actually looks very much like a pension, and where you contribute ahead of time and the government contributes. And finally, you withdraw money from the plan.
Really helpful stuff. I wish we had more time, Graham. I appreciate you giving some of yours today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Enjoy it.
Graham Treby is a principal at Bright Futures Ability Network. You can find them online, Bright Futures Ability Network. But for our listeners who are connected in some way, even tangentially, to a family with a member who has a disability, please point them to this interview or to Bright Futures Ability, because not nearly enough people know about the RDSP and the Henson Trust, and that information can go a long way. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, why are there so few female financial advisors out there? Judy Parody from strategymarketing.ca has some insight into that question. And later, Michelle Pommels from Credit Counseling Canada joins us for the Moolala questionnaire. If this is not enough Moolala for you, you can go back and download episodes from our archive. You can do that at our website, moolala.ca, or at any of the different podcast platforms out there. While you're looking on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or whatever, subscribe to the podcast so it just shows up on your device without you having to do a thing.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
The gender of a service provider can matter. It can matter to people sometimes. A massage therapist, a divorce lawyer, a child care provider. There can be all sorts of different reasons why you might want to choose someone of the same or of the opposite gender. Yet, when it comes to financial advisors, if you're looking for a female advisor, the pickings are kind of slim, or at least slimmer. Why is that? Why are there fewer female financial advisors out there? Judy Parody is with strategymarketing.ca. She is the co-author of a new white paper on this question, and she joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you? Thanks for having me.
When you say fewer, how many fewer?
Well, the numbers are stagnant pretty much at 15% across the board, except the numbers are a bit higher when it comes to salaried bank employees. But generally speaking, female financial advisors are about 15%, which is really low. And it's been the same for a long time. Yeah.
And why do you believe that female financial advisors are important to the wealth industry? I have a hypothesis, but you tell me.
Oh, gosh. Well, they couldn't be more important. Clearly, the assets that women manage are growing exponentially. It's a huge opportunity for the financial world. So they recognize that. They've also recognized that in the last number of years, female investors are increasingly looking for female advisors. So obviously, it would make sense for the financial organizations to hire more women, but they've been not doing a really great job of it.
You ask female financial advisors what some of the barriers are as a part of your research. What did you learn?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. Well, you know what? It comes down to, sadly, sort of the old boys network. They don't feel comfortable. They're discouraged. Female financial advisors are motivated very, very differently than male financial advisors. They don't look in terms of the bottom line. They look for a profession that is flexible, something that they can be passionate about. They love relationship building. And quite often when they go into these situations, into a branch, they're discouraged from doing business the way they want to do business. They're told, just pick up the phone and start making calls. And that's just not the way women like to work. So quite often when they say, hey, you know what, I want to have an event or I want to have some people over, oh, don't waste your time. That's just wasting your time. Mm. So unfortunately, they're discouraged from doing what they're really, really good at. And that's building relationships. And that, incidentally, is what female investors are looking for. That's why they're going, that's why they're looking for female advisors.
You've said that some of the metrics are male-centric. What do you mean by that? Can you give us some examples?
People are measured in terms of assets, how much they have under control and so on. There's very little value put on long-term relationship building. It's not even measured. So what women bring to the equation isn't measured in any way, shape or form. It's just not the way the financial organizations have evolved over the years. Everything is all about numbers and who has the most numbers. So that puts women at a disadvantage. disadvantage because it just isn't even counted. You know, how long have you had a client? How good is your relationship with that client? How have you grown that client from just the woman to her entire family? And or, you know, how many clients are you losing? Male financial advisors, this is how Paulette and I started. They're losing their female clients. 80% of widows leave. So, you know, that's a really telling number.
You included in your research a survey of recent graduates. What were some of the big things that you found there?
Well, you know, again, it was sort of expected. They thought it was all about money. They thought that they didn't have the skills. They still saw it as an old boys network. You know, when we ask them, what are they looking for in a job? They want something that they can be passionate about, something that they can be good at. You know, we've talked to, one woman was a teller. And she said she loved being a teller at a bank because she liked helping people. And that's what made her think of being a financial advisor. So it often stems from helping. And it's not a matter of knowing math. I thought, well, I don't know the industry. I don't know how to, trade or I don't know the financial world. And it really has very, very surprisingly very little to do with all that.
In terms of the corporate context, the big Canadian banks are very, very involved in the world of diversity and inclusion. They've got massive programs, they've got measures, they've got all sorts of things. What would be some examples of where you think the industry is doing some things right?
They're doing a lot of things right. And, you know, we don't want to slam the industry. As you know, I come from a marketing background and we did marketing for many, many years for the big banks. And yeah, they're putting women on their websites. They've got initiatives at the corporate level to hire women. They've even put in, sort of maternity type programs. I just got off a Zoom call with a woman from the States, and we call them the checkmark, you know, the checkmark items. You know, we're going after women, we're going after this demographic, tick, tick, tick. These are the things I've done. We point out in the white paper that the problem is the disconnect between corporate and where the rubber meets the road. And the rubber meets the road at the branch level. It's the branch managers that look for and hire female financial advisors. And unfortunately, they're not given a whole lot of help and they often don't know how. We've talked to some regional managers recently and she said, oh yeah, some of my branch guys are guys, unfortunately. And they just don't know where to look or how to hire female advisors. And do you know the death rate or the kill rate is almost 90%? So the women that start as financial advisors, 90% of them will fail. Incidentally, that's a pretty high number for men as well.
Yeah, but they don't last. There's a real churn.
Yeah, there's a real churn. And women in particular would last if they were mentored. You know, the really interesting thing we found is that of the successful female financial advisors who we interviewed for this research paper, almost all of them came from within the industry. The branches continue looking for people outside of the industry, people with big, I'll use an anachronism here, Rolodexes with lots of contacts, lots of women in the industry. They also continue to discourage them from doing business the way they want to. So these women all said, you know, I love building relationships. I love working with people, but I succeeded despite what was going on. That word came up time and again. I succeeded despite, we said, how did you manage in this sort of, macho kind of world? I just ignored it all. I just did my own thing.
Surely we can raise the bar a little higher than that. Judy, thank you so much.
It is my pleasure, Bruce. Anytime at all.
Judy Parody is with strategymarketing.ca. She was here to talk about the lack of female financial advisors in the industry, why that is an issue for the industry, but also for the clients that they serve. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, Michelle Pommels from Credit Counseling Canada will be here to talk about the Bill of Rights for Canadians in Debt. And don't forget to stay up to date on all things Moolala by signing up for our newsletter. It's a monthly thing, and it brings together all the stuff that I have done on this radio show, on my weekly column on CBC, on my column on CityLine, blah, blah, blah. It only comes once a month, and I do blah, blah a little bit, but I think it's worth it. We will never do anything with your email address. You can sign up at moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many Canadians are looking for reliable, for transparent credit counseling options, especially in these times. And it's pretty important to know what you can expect when you seek out these services. I talk a lot about the nonprofit credit counselors and the role that they play in Canada. Today, we're going to talk to the CEO of Credit Counseling Canada about something that they have created called a Bill of Rights for Canadians in Debt. Michelle Pommels joins us now to talk about this Bill of Rights. Hello there.
Hello there, Bruce.
I prattle on about the nonprofit credit counselors all the time because I've had a great experience working with them in all different parts of the country. Tell us about Credit Counseling Canada and what role it plays on a national level.
Thanks for having me on the show. Credit Counseling Canada is the national association of nonprofit credit counseling agencies that operate from coast to coast in Canada, helping Canadians with money management and financial counseling. Over the past 50 plus years, we've helped more than 12.5 million Canadians Wow. who have been struggling with financial debt issues.
And now you are launching something you call the Bill of Rights. What is it and what was it designed to do?
Well, we felt there was a need to create a Bill of Rights for consumers in debt, Bruce, because we saw that there was a greater need for transparency and awareness around how Canadians in financial difficulty could find unbiased, affordable, and safe debt relief options. There's a lot of confusion out there in terms of where people should turn. What precipitated this is that we did a study recently called a Got Debt survey, and we were rather surprised that 4 in 10 Canadians who found themselves in difficulty said they would have no idea where to turn for help, or indeed were concerned about the lack of focus on the financial wellness in terms of debt support, ongoing financial education. 72% actually of respondents were concerned about that. Another 70% felt there was a lack of transparency around fees and potential for conflict of interest. And so with this anxiety, we felt there was a real need to create a Bill of Rights that would help Canadians understand what it is they should expect from a reputable non-profit credit counseling, financial counseling agency.
It is laid out very, very clearly. I think there are, 7 parts to it: confidentiality, judgment-free, standards-based. But what didn't occur to me was that there would be much variability in the quality of the non-profit credit counselors. How much variability is there out there?
It's not so much that there's variability within non-profit credit counseling, but there are for-profit credit counseling players out there, which can appear similar to a non-profit credit counseling agency. And this is what concerns us. So we want to provide a tool to equip Canadians to be able to tell the difference. And so the top 7, we've reamed off a few of them there, but number 4 is it needs to be standards-based. So, for example, the agencies that work with our association, we also act as an accrediting body. So mm-hmm. we only work with charities and nonprofit credit counseling agencies, and they have to pass through a rigorous accreditation process in order for us to be satisfied that they will provide high quality services at an affordable and, in some cases, no cost basis. So that's number one. Number two, any of our members have to undergo annual audits by our association to ensure that they continue to comply with our standards. So there's quite a high bar that agencies who become part of our network have to meet.
Could the for-profit players choose to sign on to your Bill of Rights? Is that an option for them?
No.
Why not?
That is not our philosophy. We only work with nonprofits because it's a philosophy. Nonprofits are not motivated by profit. They're working with the Canadians' best interest at heart, and so are willing to forego fees should someone in difficulty be unable to pay. That's not something that you're going to find with a for-profit organization.
What do you expect the consumer's understanding of this Bill of Rights to be? Is it something that they should hold in front of them, and if they feel like something isn't being delivered, they should make a call? And if so, to whom?
Right. Absolutely. It's a tool or a lens that Canadians can apply when they're seeking out debt help. So they should be using it as a checklist and say, do they provide services that can meet these standards? So it's essentially, it's an accountability tool. And if they are working with an agency that happens to be one of our members, if there's something that they're questioning or concerned about, they can call Credit Counseling Canada, because again, we are the accrediting body for Canada's nonprofit agencies, certainly the vast majority of them. And then that's something we can support them with and work with them on if there are any cause for concern in terms of the provision of service. Again, our members must undergo annual audits to ensure that they're meeting our high bar of high quality service to Canadians. We also function as a consumer protection agency, working on behalf of Canadians to ensure that they're getting the best quality, safe, unbiased, judgment-free, nonprofit financial credit counseling services available.
Very helpful stuff. Michelle, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Michelle Pommels is the CEO of Credit Counseling Canada, and she was here to talk about the new Bill of Rights for Canadians in Debt. Well, it's time now for the Moolala Questionnaire, which is our series of questions about money and about life. Michelle Pommels is still with us. She is from Credit Counseling Canada. And Michelle, I'm going to ask you some questions, just the first thing that pops into your mind, okay?
All right, I'm ready to go.
How would you describe your money personality?
Oh, I would describe it as being analytical.
Analytical, okay. What does that mean?
Well, I weigh the pros and cons. So I'm the type of person who will do the what are the advantages, what are the disadvantages, and just so that I get a good 360 degree picture. Mm. Now, having said that, if I've got an impulse to get a certain thing, and it's in my budget, then while I still have the 360 as my lens, that doesn't mean that I might not get that item.
What are you tempted by? So you say, okay, if it's still in my budget, but what are the things that you're like, I really like to buy one of those? You could call them guilty spending pleasures. I don't call them guilty spending pleasures so much because I don't think there's anything to feel guilty about. But what are the things that you're like, ooh, I'd like that?
Well, apart from sugar-free chocolate, I must admit to really liking gadgets.
Really? Kitchen gadgets? Do you have an olive pitter or a pomegranate seed peeler?
I've wanted a pomegranate peeler,
yeah,
but they're very hard to pull. They're very hard to pull, so I've resisted.
Right. So like tech gadgets, or are you actually a closeted spy and you like need a shoe phone or something?
Not quite that extreme, but I must admit, I do like things with buttons on them. I'm always the kind of kid pressing buttons and getting into trouble.
Right. Who was your money mentor when you were a kid?
Oh, gosh, that's an interesting one. I would have to say it was my father.
What did he do that is still with you?
He would save his coins. So, you know, if he spent $10 and whatever change that, you know, he had from whatever he bought, he would put that aside in an envelope. And then, you know, at the end of the month, he would turn out the coins and then sort of distribute them amongst the kids. You know, it was ice cream money. So that simple, you know, object lesson is something that has stayed with me. So saving was important.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, $25 million, what would you do with it?
You know, I would, I've always thought that if I did come into such a windfall, I'd like to start a foundation and to give to my favorite causes. You know, in addition to taking that holiday that we're all dreaming about, that would be a goal of mine, is to start a foundation and to be really serious about, you know, how I contribute in that way to causes that are near and dear to my heart.
Well, one of those, of course, is the nonprofit credit counseling world, because you couldn't have that job if it wasn't important to you. Mm-hmm. What is one money topic that you could talk about and focus on and be passionate about every single day, and one that you're like, oh, I don't ever want to talk about insurance again? Sorry, was I projecting? I think I was projecting there.
Totally projecting, Bruce. I would say that it's about financial literacy for kids. I know that there's been some progress in the last year in terms of incorporating these lessons within the school system, but I feel that we need to go beyond, even those programs. I see time and time again, and I've worked with single parents who have said, after receiving some financial literacy education, that they wish they had known what they know now a lot sooner when they were in school. The fact is, we teach a lot of things in school, but one of the things that we do a very poor job around, I believe, is financial literacy for our kids. And especially today, we really need to include that in a very serious way on the school curriculum.
So that's on the passion front. What about on the disinterest front? Is there one you would just wish would go away?
There are a few of them, but I hesitate to say that on the air. I think this dispelling this myth that people are hesitant to talk about financial difficulties when they hit bumps in the road. The reality is that most people, are going to run into some form of financial pressure at some point during their lives. The studies have shown that the average Canadian is $200 away from debt every month. And so what I would like to see is us to engage in the discussion around our finances in a much more healthy, open way, and take the kind of attitude that, look, we go to the dentist on a regular basis. We bring in our vehicles to get serviced on a regular basis. It makes sense to get a financial health checkup on a regular basis. In fact, Credit Counseling Canada is currently offering a free financial health checkup to everyone in Canada that's got debt. We believe so passionately in the value of getting a tune-up at this time.
Ooh, I love that idea. Love a little tune-up. Michelle, thank you very much for your time and for your insight, and most importantly, for your passion for the nonprofit credit counseling world. As I mentioned earlier, these are folks who I have worked with in lots of capacities for a very, very long time, and they do an extraordinary job working with Canadians.
You're hired. Thank you, Bruce. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Michelle Pavels, CEO of Credit Counseling Canada. That was the Moolala questionnaire. Well, that is our show for today. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up for a newsletter at moolala.ca. Please subscribe to the podcast. We'd love it if you did that. We'd love it as well if you left us a review, good, bad, or otherwise. If you have comments you'd like to send directly to my attention, ask@moolala.ca is our email address. ask@moolala.ca. On social, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great day.